Now, the fourth point for promoting small-scale sector industries is special measures for tiny sector. The policy has devised a package of measures for the tiny sector only. The investment limit in plant and machinery in a unit has been raised from Rs. 5 lakh to Rs. 25 lakh, obviously to provide for the increase in the prices of capital goods, etc. Besides, the facilities available to the tiny sector as part of the small sector, it would also be eligible for additional support in terms of cheap land and power allocation and access to facilities for technology upgradation on a continuing basis, including easier access to institutional finance. Again, the policy provides for according priority to the tiny sector in the government purchase programs. Though it is not specified, the policy also provides relaxation to the tiny sector from certain provisions of the labor laws. Special measures for handloom, handicrafts, khadi and village industries. For the first time, these sectors of the small industries have been treated with special measures. Conceived as a package, these consist of several schemes and facilities. The existing schemes for the handloom sector are, for example, proposed to be revised under three major heads. Project package scheme, under which the area-based approach will be adopted to improve technology and marketing facility. Welfare package scheme, under which the number of welfare schemes will be increased and the funds earmarked for them substantially augmented. Schemes for participation in the share capital will be redrawn for imparting a better management system. Measures have also been provided to ensure the supply of substantial funds and facilities for modernization of looms, for training, for better designs, for better dyes and chemicals, and for marketing assistance. The role of the National Handloom Development Centers, that is NHDC, as also of the National Cooperative Development Corporation, that is NCDC, is being enhanced in respect of the supply of raw materials like hank iron, dyes and chemicals, as also seed money to both cotton growers, spinning mills and weavers' spinning mills. The schemes for improving marketing of handloom products in the domestic and industrial markets have also been envisaged. As for the handicraft sector, the policy envisages setting up of craft development centers to offer the following facilities: supply of raw materials, design and technical guidance, marketing support, training and procuring of related inputs in an integrated and area-based manner. Measures are also proposed to increase exports of handicrafts through new marketing channels like trading companies, departmental stores, etc. In respect of khadi and village industries, the policy promises to initiate measures to encourage activities related to R&D and better flow of credit from the financial institutions. In promoting all these activities, the policy lays greater emphasis on the quality and marketability of products in accordance with the consumer preference, rather than merely on rebates and subsidies. Critical evaluation. The new industrial policy ushers in a new era in the industrial sphere of the country. The large as also small industries are likely to undergo a sea change in respect of their working and results. We examine the policy to understand its standing vis-a-vis old policy, as also the likely consequences that will flow from its operation. Different from old policy, the elements that go to make up the new policy place it at a different footing from the old policy. The differences are to be seen in the provisions that erode the old objectives and the new means envisaged to achieve the aims of the new policy. Erosion of public sector. The objectives enshrined in the Industrial Policy Resolution of 1956, which marked the scene till the NIP came on the scene, have been much changed. In fact, to an extent, weakened and almost done away with. In the old industrial scenario, the public sector had been assigned a greater and a more crucial role in the development of industries relative to the private sector. The NIP seems to go against this key feature of the old industrial policy. There is, for example, a reduction in the number of industries reserved for the public sector from 23 to only 6. Again, the provision in the NIP to refer the public enterprises which are chronically sick and which are unlikely to be turned around to the Board for Industrial and Financial Reconstruction, that is BIFR, or other similar high-level institution, may result in the liquidation of some enterprises. Further, under the NIP, the government is to make a review of the public sector in respect of several industries, such as those based on low technology, small scale and non-strategic areas, inefficient and unproductive areas, etc. This rethinking, although sound, may result in the closure or privatization of some of the public sector units, further reducing their number. Moreover, the disinvestment of public holdings of some of the public enterprises would subject these enterprises to the discipline of market forces. Because of this, the public sector will lose some of its public character. Following this erosion of the public ownership and public character of the public sector, the growth of basic and capital goods industries will no longer be its exclusive or even main concern. Their growth, despite their key importance for the economy, will be conditioned by market signals. More concentration of economic power and less regional balance. The two other old objectives likely to be affected adversely are the prevention of concentration of economic power in private hands and promotion of regional balance. The amendment of the MRTP Act to remove the threshold limit of assets in respect of MRTP companies and confining only to the malpractices of the business houses, including the public sector units, means no concern for the size of the companies. This provision naturally runs counter to the objective of the prevention of concentration of economic power in private hands. The objective of reducing or eliminating inequalities in the industrial development of different regions or states will also remain far from achieved. In fact, with the delicensing of large many industries and easing of procedures, as also the locational policy, the new policy may reinforce the attraction of the already developed regions or states. This is obvious from the fact that while liberalizing of licensing and procedures gives the freedom to set up any industry except those reserved for the public sector, the locational policy shows concern about the big cities of over 1 million population and rural and backward areas without the least regard for the regional imbalances. As such, the NIP goes against the objective of ensuring regional balance. Greater reliance on market. Another important feature which distinguishes the NIP from the old policy is in respect of the use of market. Under the NIP, the market has been assigned a very large area where it will operate. This is obvious from the large many industries which have been delicensed. The easy entry of foreign private direct investment to the extent of majority ownership in their projects will also strengthen the market-related competitive forces. So is the case of agreements relating to the transfer of foreign technology into the country. These agreements, largely in the sphere of private sector, will further enhance the market forces emanating from the foreign industrially developed market economies. The limiting of the public sector to a smaller number of industries than before will also expand the area of operation for the private sector. The amendment to the MRTP Act with no threshold limit on their assets will further strengthen the economic power of the private sector. All this amounts to the use of market or market prices for the allocation of resources among the various industries. The use of market incentives, namely profits, wages, rent and interest, or the prices of factors of production, will also predominate as the motives of the owner of factors for participation in economic activities. This new profile of the industrial economy is in total contrast to what has gone before, when the decisions in respect of production capacities, products, etc. used to be concentrated in the hands of administrators. Globalization of the economy. Besides providing for large private sector, a greater role of market and competition and the market-related incentives, the NIP aims at integrating the domestic economy with the world economy. The removal of restrictions on the private domestic as also private foreign entrepreneurs in respect of large number of industries brings the domestic market near to the world market. The entry of foreign direct investments and technology will link Indian investment and technology profiles to those of foreign countries. The entry and exit of foreign companies into and out of India in terms of commercial consideration, that is profitability of their projects, will powerfully influence the economic decisions of the domestic entrepreneurs. If one reads these features of the NIP alongside the recent changes made in the areas of foreign exchange rates, trade and fiscal affairs, involving devaluation of the rupee as also its convertibility, permitting imports of many goods freely, lowering of tariff rates, etc., one is right in inferring that the thrust of the above-mentioned measures is to move towards an open economy. This is in total contrast to the position before, when the economy, through involved in exchanging goods and services with other countries, as also inviting foreign capital, was a controlled one and to an extent a closed one. Growth with efficiency. The thrust of the NIP is to step up the growth rate of industrial production through an efficient use of resources. The NIP will also enlarge the quantity of resources. But while providing for larger resource inputs, the NIP aims at raising the productivity of both the existing and the additional resources. Sources of efficiency. The various changes in the NIP will improve efficiency of the industrial economy in several ways. The dismantling of several controls like licensing, automatic approvals of business proposals, and simplification of procedures will eliminate the need for prior approvals and or filling of large many forms and or running about from office to building to build contact, spend money, etc., to seek permission as per rules or seek favors. The time and resources thus saved will be used to produce more. This in turn will reduce the cost of production. Significant improvement in efficiency will also take place through an increase in competition, which the changes in the MRTP Act will foster. With the threshold limit of assets to identify a monopoly of, the scope of the MRTP Commission to probe into the business malpractices of all the establishment will increase. The scope of the operation of the MRTP Act has further increased with the public sector enterprises having been bought within its orbit. The strengthening of the MRTP Commission will also enhance its powers to curb anti-competition forces. The changes in the public sector will also add to the efficiency of industries. The NIP has, for example, drastically reduced the number of industries reserved for this sector. The entry of private sector in the now de-reserved industries will improve the working of these industries in terms of their production. This is a case of allocative efficiency. Again, with the proposal of the NIP to refer to the BIFR or a similar institution, the six public sector enterprises, it is very likely that some of them may be closed and some of them rehabilitated. In either case, the production will go up. In the case of closures, the resources thus released can be used for raising production somewhere else. This again in a case of improvement by way of allocation. In the latter case, the enterprises will become more productive with an improvement in their working. The performance of the public sector will also improve with the proposed changes in respect of their working. For example, the NIP promises to make memorandum of understanding between the enterprises and the concerned ministries more effective. Through their purposeful formulation and implementation and their monitoring, there is also the proposal to grant greater autonomy to these enterprises and professionalize their operations. Further, with the privatization of a part of the ownership of these enterprises, their working will be subjected to the stock market discipline. This in turn will improve their efficiency. Another very important source of improved efficiency is the foreign direct investment. This will bring into the country resources which are of high quality and more productive. These investments will bring in modern machines, latest technologies, and sophisticated managerial and marketing expertise. The developed business culture and work ethos, which will accompany foreign investments and technology, will also result in more output per unit of input, thereby raising the productivity of resources. Addition to resources, the industrial production will also go up because of the availability of more resources. With the elimination of the cobweb of controls, the businesses will come up with an increasing number of projects which will be profitable in terms of market criteria. This is bound to raise the rewards for capital. This in turn will be a big inducement to savers. Already this has started happening with many companies getting their financial needs adequately met from the private sources, largely through the sale of shares. The entrepreneurial talent will also increase and flower in this free environment. Additions to resources will also be made from foreign sources. The foreign direct investments will add to the foreign exchange supply. Since the foreign companies have the reputation of being very efficient, they will easily raise the rupee part of their investments, which in turn will add to the investable resources. The almost automatic approval for the agreement relating to the transfer of technologies will benefit the country in terms of sophisticated machines, tools, etc. This means not only a mere addition of resources, but that of superior resources. Prospects of fast growth. With the expected improvement in efficiency and additions to resources, the growth rate of industrial production should go up. The growth rate in the last 4 decades or so had been of the order of 6% per annum. In the 1980s, it has been higher at 8% per annum. The NIP may raise it further, around 10% per annum or even more. This expectation is based upon two solid facts. One is the experience of the 1970s and 80s, when industrial policy statements of 1973, 85 and 86 initiated in a significant way the liberalization of policies and procedures. These policy changes permitted the entry of large industrial houses and foreign companies in the high priority areas. Emphasis was also laid on the promotion of competition in the domestic market, technological upgradation, exports and foreign investments. Again, it is during this period, beginning from the mid-60s, that industrial growth picked up and was sustained at a higher level. In view of all this, it can be safely contended that the pro-private sector environment during this period has been an important factor in raising the industrial growth over the long run figure of 6%. Another reason to believe that the growth rate will go up is the good response of the stock market, considered to be a very good barometer of the business psychology or expectations. The stock markets in the country boomed following the package of government policies liberalizing the economy, and this is despite the fact that the corporate sector was not given any concession in the budget of 1991 and 92. On the contrary, there was an enhancement of the tax rate alongside a reduction in the allowance for depreciation. This optimistic outlook is likely to continue despite recent setbacks and despite a recessionary trend in industrial production. As such, it is right to infer that the stock exchanges have been buoyant because the business feels more than amply compensated by the very liberal dose of liberalization. A mixed deal for small sectors. The NIP, in its zeal to marketize the economy as also to free the private sector from the government interference, has made provisions, some of which are helpful for small sector, but there are some that seem to harm them. The net result, this way or that, though uncertain in precise terms, may be less favorable than it should be. Beneficial elements. The NIP provides for almost all that the small sector, including tiny sector, needs for their sound growth. The supply of inputs, in particular raw materials, is ensured. Much has been done to provide credit in adequate quantities, including participation of non-SSI enterprises in the form of equity capital to the extent of 24%. Provision has also been made for the supply of risk capital through partnership. Arrangements have also been made for a proper marketing of their products. To ensure their viability, their production program are to be integrated with the large private and public sector units. Emphasis has also been laid on measures to improve the quality of their products. There are special measures for the handloom, handicrafts, khadi and village industries which are intended to improve their technologies and marketing facilities, welfare schemes and management systems. These industries will continue to get the protection so far extended to them, and in addition there is something more. For example, a large number of items for production continues to be reserved for them. The tiny sector is also subsidized in respect of land and power allocation and easier access to institutional finance. This sector is also favored with priority in regard to the government purchases and so on and so forth. Harmful effects. While the various provisions seem to help the small sector to stand on its own, the actual results may not be very rosy. There are two strong factors that may upset substantially the smooth growth of this sector. One is the erosion of the support that these industries used to get in respect of their inputs. Take for instance the most important input, namely credit. The emphasis in the new policy is on the adequacy of credit and not on cheap credit. These small producers are in dire need of adequate and timely credit as well as cheap credit. Adequate credit makes commercial sense for those enterprises which are run on strictly business lines. This is not the case of large many of the small and tiny units. In respect of some of the other needs too, this sector is to fend for itself. In the new approach of the government, it seems to have been forgotten that this sector has to be assisted for more than one reason. Economic viability is only one of them. However, more harmful thing for this sector can be the NIP package, which unleashes fierce competitive forces. The play of market forces fostered by de-licensing, unrestricted growth of monopoly, easy entry of foreign direct or equity investment and technology, etc., is very likely to affect adversely the already weak small sector. This sector may also lose much because of the participation of the large enterprises in its equity, as also because of its integration in the production programs of the large sector. The large sector, by turning small units as its ancillaries or complementary units, may corner most of the benefits meant for it. Several shortcomings. While the NIP has much to promote growth and efficiency, it has paid little attention to a number of serious problems. As such, the industrial scene continues to be marked by some highly unsatisfactory features. Overlooking employment. One important aspect of the economy which has been neglected in the NIP is that of generation of employment to match with the increase in the labor force. This is particularly so in the organized sector comprising of large and medium industries. In the 80s, the employment generation in this sector was as low as 1.55% a year, whereas the labor force grew at 2.1% a year. Equally significant is the dismal fact that the employment in the organized private sector manufacturing declined from 45.66 lakh in the early 80s to 43.89 lakh in the late 80s. In the organized public sector too, the annual employment growth rate dropped from 5% in the 60s to almost half at 2.6% in the 1980s. The NIP seems to turn its focus away from this problem and displays the same fetish for growth alone as has been the case during the 80s. This is also obvious from the following facts. The industries like the petrochemicals, chemicals and allied products and electrical machinery and appliances, which were the prime movers of industrial growth in the 80s, continue to be in the lead even at present. These industries are technologically rigid in terms of factor proportions. Hence, employment generating capacity of these industries is limited. Again, the industrial growth in the 80s has been more capital intensive, energy intensive and import intensive. All these characteristics indicate the low labor absorption capacity of the industrial growth. Unfortunately, the NIP is almost silent in specifying measures to rectify these lopsided industrial structure, which is marked by chemical-based industries and consumer durable industries. These are the industries in which we do not have comparative advantage. Equally importantly, there is little provision to shift the emphasis on to industries related to basic metal and alloys and machinery and machine tools. These are the industries in which we have comparative advantage and which are employment intensive. Incidentally, these are the industries which commanded the leadership in the late 1950s and 60s. Rather than increasing employment, the NIP may actually worsen it. The foreign investments along with foreign technologies that the NIP allows almost freely can do little in this regard because these are capital intensive in nature. No wonder that the NIP makes only a passing reference to the subject of employment by saying that it is to maintain a sustained growth in production and employment, expressed in terms of the lack of specific measures for increasing employment. It amounts to saying that, as before, the employment will be a byproduct of industrial growth of the type which prevailed during the 80s. Unresolved issues. It is in its concern rather over concern for liberalization, the NIP seems to have ignored some very important matters about the pattern of industrial development. One is the need to reorient the industrial production so as to conform it to the country's endowments or potentials. We have above referred to the suitability of the development of metal and metal-based industries in which the country has comparative advantage in terms of raw material and manpower. There are a host of other industries also which needs to be provided a space and support on similar grounds. Garment manufacturing based on indigenous raw cotton is one such industry. It is labor intensive also. It has a great potential for further increases in exports as the rich consumer in the West is moving away from the artificial to the nature-based apparel. However, for want of adequate weaving and manufacturing facilities, we export raw cotton on a considerable scale. Again, the viability of engineering industry needs to be re-examined as its growth is declining while it has registered a high growth in the export sector, largely because of huge subsidies. Marine products and manufacture of leather goods are other industries which have indigenous raw materials and labor in abundance, and which are labor intensive and hold out a promise of massive increase in exports. Another important matter overlooked by the NIP concerns the linkages between the industry and agriculture. The petrochemicals and the chemical-based industries, which at present occupy a high position in the industrial scenario, have little to offer by way of providing links with agriculture. This brings in the question of agriculture-based industries, which take machines from industrial sector and raw materials and manpower from the rural sector and gives to both a variety of items of consumption. Besides, these industries can produce much for exports. But unfortunately, this industry has not received any special mention in the NIP. No exit provision. One serious drawback of NIP is that it altogether ignores some important requirements without which the policy makes little sense. One is the lack of provisions facilitating exit for the entrepreneurs. There are many removals or relaxations of restrictions which make for easy entry into industry, but there is very little to get out if the business goes into losses and there is no hope of recovery. This facility to stage exit is all the more necessary for the old weak units because the entry of large many new industries, they will be under great strain. An exit policy is in fact essential also for the new entrants, for no rational producer can be expected to enter a market which he may not be able to exit when going is not so good or when he wants to change over to for a profitable line. Little for labor. Linked with this is another requirement which concerns labor. A practical exit policy presupposes cooperation from labor, which will be the most adversely affected party in case of a closure of a business. This requires that provisions are made to compensate them and or train or help them to find jobs elsewhere. Alongside this, it is essential that labor-employer relations are placed on a basis which minimizes conflicts arising from changes in the industrial profile of the country, which the NIP will usher in. In fact, the labor should also be associated with the working of the enterprises, that it also takes on the responsibility of pushing through the reorganization of the industrial structure to make it more productive. Administrative hurdles. Another essential element for the success of the NIP is that the freedom of enterprise should percolate at every level of administration. The NIP embodies intentions and actions of the central government alone. These, no doubt, are important but not sufficient for an effective implementation of the liberal policy. There are a number of things which need to be done at the state level and below it. For example, an industrialist wanting to set up a producing unit may not require license from the central government, but he will have to acquire land, get building plan sanctioned, seek electricity and water connections, etc. For all these, he has to approach administration at the state or district or city or village level. The rules and procedures at these levels can hinder or delay the projects and thereby nullify the objectives of NIP. Little for R&D. The NIP seems to confine to the liberalization of the environment for dynamic industrial development. This no doubt is important, but no less important is the role of research and development in making industry innovative in respect of the resource use, processes and products and their marketing. There are a very few passing references to this aspect in the NIP, but this is far from adequate. Two key factors in this field have been left out. One is in respect of the size of resources and sources from which these activities are to be financed. In these fields, both the private and the public sectors have to contribute a lot. With greater participation by the latter, there is, however, nothing about is that has been included in the NIP. Another issue in this field concerns the question of the intellectual property rights, that is, protection of the inventions in the form of patent, trademark and copyright. At present, the Indian Patent Act of 1970 protects the interest of the inventors and the consumers, as it should be. It rightly protects and encourages the R&D in processes rather than in products in such areas as pharmaceuticals, pesticides and chemicals. The present-day developed countries too, in their first stage of development, concentrated on the protection of processes, and it is only after they became fully developed and they started protecting products rather than processes. The UK, for instance, did it in 1948, Germany in 1961, and Japan in 1978. India, being in the early stages of development, should not only continue with it but expand the areas of protection. It is of utmost importance if progress in science and technology is to be promoted. Uncertain prospects for SSI. The provisions relating to the small sector do not amount to any coherent and definite picture for this sector. On balance, however, the future of these industries is not clear. 3 points substantiate this assessment. One is, with regard to the credit supply, the NIP places stress on the adequacy of credit rather than cheap credit, as has been the case so far. Though not spelt out in the policy, this shift means that credit will now be available to the small sector on the same terms and conditions as per applicable to large industries. This approach may starve these industries of credit, as they are a disadvantaged lot in the total industrial setup and weak in relation to large industries when seeking institutional credit. 2. The NIP, in its zeal to integrate the production programs of these industries with large industries, may actually make them dependent upon or even appendages of the big industries. Further, the provision to allow non-SSI industries to own 24% of the equity capital of these industries will tie their fortunes to the working of large industries over which they have no control. All this goes against the very concept of small sector, which not only provides income and work but self-employment on a small scale and an independent life to the workers or owners. 3. The forces of competition which the NIP will unleash may prove much too much for these small industries to stand. This is especially so in the case of tiny industries, which may even crumble in the fierce battle of survival. What all this amounts to is that while the NIP is good in some very important ways, it needs to be modified in several respects so that it attends to the various problems that have been left out or have not been properly or adequately dealt with. This will, so to say, complete the package for fast and healthy industrial development. With this, we have come to the end of this book, name of the book Indian Economy, written by A.N. Agarwal. We have covered total 9 chapters. This book is used for commerce students. Any suggestion for improving the quality of recording is always welcome. Please contact Mitra Jyoti. Mitra Jyoti family wishes you every success in your exams. Hope you have enjoyed this book and benefited from its listening. Reader's name is Asha. Thank you. Jai Hind.